Avoid overheating. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by William Oram with help from Mary Alice Cox at the Bloomington Veterinary Hospital. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
Let's turn our attention now to sports. A week after leading his club to the Stanley Cup Championship, Mike Babcock has agreed to a 3-year contract extension with Detroit. The Red Wings are 162, 56, and 28 during Babcock's 3 seasons behind the bench. The U.S. men's volleyball team will face Venezuela, and the women will play Japan in their opening matches at the Beijing Olympics. The draw for the preliminary rounds took place today for the 12 men's and 12 women's squads, which were divided into 6-team round-robin pools based on world rankings. Vinny Del Negro is officially the new head coach of the Chicago Bulls. Bulls general manager John Paxson introduced Del Negro as the team's new leader today, ending a 7-week search. Paxson says Del Negro distinguished himself from the other head coach candidates that he interviewed. He says the new coach has, quote, a strong ability to lead, communicate, and bring a fresh, energized approach. The NBA Finals between the Lakers and the Celtics are on hold until tomorrow night. The Los Angeles Lakers cut Boston's lead to 2-1 last night with an 87-81 victory. The home team has captured all 3 games in the best-of-7 showdown. NASCAR's most storied race team is giving up control of an organization that has been family-run since 1949. Petty Enterprises has sold majority ownership to the equity firm of Boston Ventures. And let's take a look now at some of the games that are ahead of us today in Major League Baseball. When Ryan Dempster takes the mound for the Chicago Cubs tonight, he'll try to remain perfect at Wrigley Field while helping the Cubs to a 10th straight home victory. The St. Louis Cardinals expect to be without injured slugger Albert Pujols when they play the middle game of their series with Cincinnati tonight. Pujols had to be helped off the field with what was diagnosed as a strained left calf in the Cards' 7-2 win last night. And the White Sox will try to snap a 4-game skid away from home when they continue their 3-game set with the Detroit Tigers tonight. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the Blair Hall Restoration at Eastern Illinois University, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
Wayne County, Michigan, home to Detroit, has been hit hard by the housing slump. The county has inherited so many properties, it has more vacant land than it knows what to do with. One nonprofit is now turning those properties into urban farms. NPR's Charla Bear has the story.
Driving around Wayne County, you're bombarded with an overwhelming number of boarded-up homes. Neighborhoods are littered with vacant land, covered in knee-high grass. Demolished apartment complexes have left empty lots the size of football fields.
I've lived in L.A., New York, and Connecticut, London, Minneapolis. But I've never seen this kind of long stretches of unused land.
That's Tasha Seville. She's standing on a bare lot between 2 single-family homes. A foreclosed house was torn down there last year. Seville and a group of volunteers pulled all the weeds and laid fresh topsoil so they could plant neat rows of tomatoes and collard greens. Seville founded a nonprofit called Urban Farming to plant food for the needy on vacant city land. She says Detroit was the perfect place to start. The city has long suffered from a glut of available property, and last year it topped the nation in foreclosures. Wayne County now has about 7,000 idle plots. Seville saw that as an opportunity.
It has so much unused land, which has been a burden to the city and the county. Now we can flip that around and make that into a positive.
This year, Wayne County is letting Urban Farming take over 20 of its derelict properties. Under the pilot program, volunteers will tend the garden, and the city of Detroit will pitch in water. Wayne County Treasurer Raymond Wojtovich says that's a huge boon.
It won't cost the county anything because we're donating the land for this operation. If a person wants to purchase a lot, that will be for sale. And perhaps it'll be an inducement.
He says the biggest benefit, though, is less blight. And residents say that unlike abandoned houses, the gardens aren't targeted by vandals.
Everybody around the neighborhood respects it because they see that we're doing something to help the community.
Eric Parrish has lived in Detroit for more than 15 years. He says he recently started gardening with Urban Farming because it helps turn things around in his city.
You can tell people are struggling, you know, and things are not how they should be in life, you know. So when I do see these plots of lands, it just makes me really say, oh, I want a garden there.
Parrish says most people are grateful for the gardens, although at first a few were concerned they'd attract pests. Turns out, what urban farms do attract is people, says Gail Carr, one of Detroit's city managers. She boards up houses nearly every day and sees what a dramatic difference these gardens have on communities.
People are coming out of their homes that would not come out under normal circumstances because they didn't think they had a reason to come out, or they didn't think there was still a community or a neighbor. And then once the community get out, they realize, oh my God, we can have food, we can grow our food, and we can take care of this land, and that's a blessing to me.
The gardens aren't fenced off, so anyone can wander through and pick fresh vegetables for free. And any leftover produce is donated to food banks. Treasurer Wojtowicz says the county is watching the program and hopes to expand it. Tasha Seville isn't waiting around. She plans to plant hundreds of gardens in at least a dozen other struggling cities this season. Charla Bear, NPR News.
If $4 a gallon gas is causing you to drive a little bit less, you may be saving in another way. You may be eligible for lower car insurance rates. Wendy Kaufman has more.
Insurance rates are based on a number of factors, including how much you drive and how you use your car. J. Robert Hunter of the Consumer Federation of America says consumers who've cut back on their driving should get a break.
For example, if you used to drive to work, say, 20 miles each way, and now you're walking to the bus stop and taking a bus all the way, that could be significant, 15-20%.
But if your driving habits have changed only slightly, the savings could be much smaller or non-existent. Insurance companies typically classify the kind of driving you do. So if you stop driving your car to work, your classification could change from drive to work to pleasure. That would likely result in a lower premium. Similarly, many insurers have a breakpoint at 10,000 annual miles. Drive more, the rates go up. Drive less, the rates go down. Thus, if you're on the borderline, even a slight change in driving habits could result in a lower rate category. Gene Salvatore of the industry-funded Insurance Information Institute encourages consumers whose driving patterns have changed to contact their insurance provider.
If you really cut down on your driving, you should definitely call your insurance company and let them know. The thing that people need to remember is that discounts do vary by company and also by state.
California drivers could benefit most. Under state law, the number of miles driven is a key element in determining an individual's insurance premium. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's one of the eternal questions, paper or plastic? The bags are both recyclable, but only paper bags come from a renewable resource. Since only 1% of all the plastic bags on Earth are actually recycled, Lisa Ann Pinkerton reports that some cities and even one national company are wondering if we need plastic bags at all.
Americans send around 100 billion plastic bags to landfills every year, where they're supposed to be compacted by bulldozers. That is, unless they catch the wind and transform into mini parachutes. Carmine Camillo is a spokesman for the national company Waste Management.
The tree lines and the fence lines can be littered with bags until we get a chance to get out there and clean them up.
This happens so much around the world, it's picked up the name tree condoms. Besides that, they clog storm drains and eventually end up in waterways and oceans where fish mistake them for jellyfish. The solution, it would seem, is to recycle them. But shopper Mary Jo Wycliffe says that's too much of a hassle.
You unload your groceries and you go home and you throw them away. That's what I do with them.
Since Wycliffe shops at the organic market Whole Foods, she says she's been doing less of that because the chain recently bagged the plastic. Cleveland store manager Sherry Wiseman says to stop offering plastic bags is a decision that goes against Business School 101.
It costs us more money to buy our paper recyclable bags, but we feel that that expense is worth it to keep the plastics out.
Whole Foods paper bags are made from 100% recycled content. And shopper Bruce Kane says it's about time plastic went out of style.
I think China has fines for stores that use plastic. So I think it's a positive trend. I'm glad to see it coming to Whole Foods and coming to the United States.
The trendsetter in this country is San Francisco. It's the only city to successfully ban plastic bags. New York City, Annapolis, Maryland, New Haven, Connecticut, Santa Monica, and Portland are looking to shun plastic too. But the bruising the city of Oakland took might make them think twice. A plastics industry group called the Coalition to Support Plastic Bag Recycling sued Oakland over its ban and won. It claimed the city didn't do its homework on alternatives such as compostable plastic bags or a recycling program. Sharon Canese is a spokeswoman for the plastics industry at the American Chemistry Council.
We certainly hope that the city of Oakland will work with the state of California on recycling, because it doesn't belong in the roadways, it belongs in the recycling bin.
Plastic bags are made from petroleum and natural gas, but Canese says their manufacture and transport uses 70% less energy and produces half the carbon dioxide that making paper bags does. But for some, choosing between paper and plastic isn't enough. A few people are starting to shop with reusable cloth bags. Some stores sell them for about a dollar, and Walmart recently gave away 1 million free to its customers. But the concept of bringing their own bags to the store is still foreign to some Walmart shoppers.
It really doesn't matter to me, but I'm going to need a bigger bag than this.
It's easier to just throw these out and come back to the store with nothing in their hands.
Well, it's just becoming popular, so I'll start to.
Whether it's paper, plastic, or cloth, each can be environmentally friendly if consumers go to the extra effort. But if people keep throwing them away, local governments might attempt to reduce plastic bag use. A move the plastics industry will certainly contest. For the Environment Report, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton.
You've probably seen websites or emails collecting consumer warnings that someone found particularly ridiculous. But those warnings are there for a reason, even when they seem silly. Commentator Amy Guida takes us on a wild subway ride in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
I used to practice law in Washington, D.C., and I worked on a number of cases involving subway injuries. If an escalator in the subway stopped suddenly or someone got his fingers caught in the side of an escalator, I handled the case for the company that maintained the escalators. That means that I'm profoundly aware of the dangers inherent in certain subway systems and similarly aware of the multiple warnings of those dangers. Let me put it this way. You know those warning signs about holding the handrail and holding a child's hand on the escalator and not using an escalator to transport a stroller up to the next level? Those are there for a reason. Accidents happen, and those warnings help protect those who work on subway systems from liability. Now the rest of the story. I'm riding on the subway in New York City recently, and I notice a poster, one in a series of safety posters printed up by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. It reads, "Surf the web, not the train," and "The only safe ride is the inside." And I'm not joking about this. There's a picture of a man grabbing the outside of a subway train, like a far less buff Spider-Man clings to a wall, and hanging on for the ride and for dear life. Yep, he's riding a subway car on the outside. A couple of weeks later, an announcement comes over the intercom during another one of my subway rides, something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, for your safety, please do not ride on the outside of subway cars." Now, I'm a lawyer who's well-versed in warnings on subway systems. I know how carefully worded the warning messages are to avoid liability. But never in a million years did I think it would be necessary to warn about the dangers of riding on the outside of a subway car, clinging to the door as would the common housefly. So I set out to find any reported court decisions or reports in general involving people who ride on the outside of subway cars, thinking that something must have sparked this safety campaign. I can now tell you that some people have more brain power than others. That whole surf the web, not the train thing, that's because some actually ride atop train cars until they jump off or a tunnel decides to do it for them. Others actually do ride as the would-be Spider-Man on the outside of subway cars. One guy actually managed to make an obscene gesture at a video camera operator just before he fell off. Those train surfers haven't sued, based on the reported cases I've read at least. You might think that that's because they're dead, or because no judge would allow the case to get beyond a very preliminary motion to dismiss, filed the instant the complaint reached the defendant's desk. But you'd be wrong. That's because I found several cases involving people who take related risks in New York and then sue for their injuries. And yes, some of the cases are really sad, like the boy who died when he rode atop an elevator, or the teen who died while attempting to view a clandestine graffiti mural inside a working